This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. During our Sunshine Week series, 90.7's news director Catherine Welch looked into what happens when someone exhibiting mental health issues becomes a neighbourhood menace. Now, the man in question had a police record, had been in and out of court, and neighbours were worried about their safety and frustrated by what seemed to them a lack of response by law enforcement. A plea posted on the Nextdoor app read, "Someone should do something," and that caught Catherine's eye and started a probe into this one man's journey through the criminal justice system. Catherine Welch joins us now. Catherine, thanks for being here, and tell us, what's the story now?
Sure. So this man, his name is Peter Dunn. His family lives in the Orlando neighborhood of Audubon, and neighbors started reporting on the app about a year ago that he was riding his bike and he'd have either a long stick and hit people on the sidewalk with the stick, or in one case, he had a big bag of cans and he hit a lady with a bag of cans. And then last summer, it turns out he got his driver's license back. He had it revoked back in 2014. He got it back. And he was driving a car this time, a red Jetta, and he would drive at other motorists on the road, like chicken style. Or if he saw a family on their bicycles, he'd veer toward them and then pull away at the last minute, or he'd sort of head toward people walking. He was in this neighborhood because this is where his mom lived.
Do you know why he had his driver's license revoked in the first place?
This stems back to a battery charge, which is a misdemeanor, back in 2014, and just sort of going through that whole case file, I saw that he eventually did everything he needed to do, and he got his driver's license back. So his mom lived in this neighborhood. This is why he was frequently in it. And it got to the point where actually there was a school bus stop directly across the street from his mom's house. And residents tell me they pleaded with the school district, just move it one block over. So parents would sit there with their cell phones on 911 just in case, like every morning. So, I mean, this was clearly an issue to residents. They call police. They brought this up at neighborhood meetings with police. And so Orlando Police Department, their Corporal Kevlon Kirkpatrick, he told them, call 911, say you want to file a report, and say you want to press charges. And so that's what they started to do. They would report him, and then they would find a couple days later he's back out on the streets.
So the police department was responding when 911 was called. They would pick him up and book him into the jail?
Well, there was one instance where he was driving at a resident named Maggie Finley, and she called and said, I want to file a report. I want to press charges. And hours after her run-in, he actually did that chicken thing with an Orlando police officer. At that point, they decided to Baker Act him. And when she said, why aren't you pressing charges? They said, we have the discretion not to. Here's Corporal Kirkpatrick talking about that.
When they encountered him, they realized that he was not trying to hurt them. He had a mental challenge, and therefore they provided him with the services that they felt he needed. And that's our objective, to provide the services that people needed to solve temporarily, if you will, the challenge that is faced by the community and the officers. And they exercised discretion and decided not to arrest him, but to take him to a facility, a central receiving facility.
You pulled police records, Catherine Welch, and court records on this man, Peter Dunn. How extensive was his record?
It wasn't as thick as I thought it would be. He does have run-ins that go back to 2003, and these are mostly where he's terrorizing his elderly mother. He has battery charges, but nothing more than a misdemeanor.
What was the outcome of this story? What happened in the end?
So this story has a very sad ending. The day after Christmas, Peter Dunn was found dead in a motel room with some of his medications by his bedside and bottles sort of strewn across the room.
Well, I want to pull in public defender for the Ninth Judicial Circuit, Robert Wesley, into this conversation. Robert, thanks for being here first. And here's a guy, Peter Dunn, who's clearly a threat to himself and to others, but he doesn't have any felonies on his record. What do the courts balance given caseloads? I mean, how do you approach a case like Peter Dunn's?
Well, in Florida's Baker Act, which is a civil remedy, so that allows a person to be taken into custody for determination of whether they're at risk of themselves or someone else, would have fit the bill here. I don't understand why the process was, after being evaluated by a psychologist or a psychiatrist within that period that he was held, why the determination wasn't made, especially based on the other information. What the law enforcement officer indicated is one strong feature that we have in the community, and that was the central receiving facility. Police officers have a tough job to do, and when they get a complaint call from a citizen, the citizen wants that problem to go away. And the way that typically goes away, the tool that law enforcement officers do is a physical arrest to take someone into custody. And for about 8+ years in this jurisdiction, we've had the benefit of a central receiving facility where the police officer, instead of taking the person to jail and waiting to book them in for many hours, can drop them off at a mental health treatment facility. Our wonderful facility is run jointly by the provider of the local mental health provider, Aspire, which also is partnered with the Center for Drug-Free Living. Mm-hmm. And it's really about a 15-minute process to drop a person off there. And those of us in the system really do know the people's history. The frequent flyers are the problem, not that we have a lot of unknown people that come in. So this should have been caught. But the criminal justice system is never going to fix this problem. It's going to happen through the health system and through the mental health system. Unfortunately, we in Florida are 49th out of the 50 states in mental health funding. I think that we rest only on the shoulders of Utah. So Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia all provide more than we do for our citizens. And we have a very, very diverse community with a lot of stressors of populations coming from places that have hurricanes and no utilities and PTSD from a variety of sources in lots of different countries. And so we know that we have the need, the very clear demonstrated need. We just don't have the resources.
So what you're saying is there are a lot of people with mental health issues who end up in the court system.
Well, in every single jurisdiction, I dare say, I certainly know for here in Florida, the largest mental health facility in the county is the jail.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Rikers Island last night medicated 3,000 people in New York City jails. The L.A. County Jail medicated 3,500 people in the jail setting just with mental health drugs. And so the default position that happened in 1963 was just to take a health problem that used to be solved with institutionalization mm-hmm. in a bad way and then just shove it on the criminal justice system and then use the detention facilities there.
I understand there's a point system, so a misdemeanor has fewer points than a felony. How do these points come into play when deciding what to do with a defendant? How does that work?
Well, I mean, all bets are off if there's a mental health problem, autism spectrum problem, intellectual disability. That's not the typical case that's confined by any routine disposition system. Mm-hmm. We have a moral obligation, if not a pragmatic obligation, to try and treat the person who's in front of us and do what we can for them, especially when we know that if not addressed, it will be recurring. And that's mm-hmm. exactly what we see time after time.
So the Baker Act is the state law that allows law enforcement, judges, doctors, to commit somebody involuntarily up to 72 hours. But when that person goes before the judge in their Baker Act hearing, they're being judged at that point in time. The entirety of their record doesn't come into play. Robert Wesley, why is that? Well, explain how this works.
We have the responsibility, the public defenders in Florida have the responsibility of representing the people in the Baker Act hearing. And the simple issue is whether the person needs treatment and mm-hmm. whether the treatment can be done in the community, whether the treatment or whether it requires admission to the state hospital. Of course, a person does not get to the process of appearing before a judge for a hearing if they're determined not to need treatment and they're discharged. And so I don't think it's a hard test for the mental health professionals who evaluate the people when they're picked up on the petition. Mm-hmm. And the determination does do pretty quickly. But I think that a lot of us are confined by HIPAA, that whatever we know about a person's health history, whether it's tuberculosis or knee pain or mental health issues, still is confidential.
Right.
But because that we have the institutional knowledge of the providers that people can recognize, here comes Ricky, Bobby's here again, and Mary's in the corner. They have a pretty good idea who those people are, mm-hmm. especially the people with schizophrenia.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. We're talking with Robert Wesley and Catherine Welch about the intersection between mental health and the criminal justice system. And I want to bring Frankie Berger into the conversation. Frankie Berger is the Director of Advocacy at the Treatment Advocacy Center. It's a nonprofit out of the Washington, D.C. area, which promotes laws and policies for mental health care. Frankie, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
So Florida, as we were saying, has the Baker Act. It does allow for 72 hours of involuntary treatment. It's a solution for the short term, but what do state laws have in place for long-term care?
Sure. It really depends on the state. So Robert really hit the nail on the head with what he was talking about facing Florida right now. The problem is that the Baker Act does facilitate the 72-hour emergency evaluation in a really beneficial way compared to many other states. So your emergency evaluation criteria, that threshold that it takes to actually get you under evaluation for a short period of time, it's a pretty good standard in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
But what's happening is it's very difficult for an individual to be committed to resources that don't exist in the community, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in this resource-starved environment where there aren't enough mental health care access issues, right, there isn't community behavioral health care available to people. There aren't inpatient beds available to people that need them. Florida has an expanded Medicaid, which is sort of an elephant in the room, but a lot of these folks, especially with schizophrenia, these are severe and persistent illnesses, and a lot of those folks qualify and are Medicaid beneficiaries. And so we're in this difficult space where you can get someone under evaluation to see if they need treatment and care for 72 hours, but after that, where are you putting people if they need this level of treatment? And so the judges and everyone else involved are asked to make really tough decisions about who's going to get access to the treatment that they need at any given point in time.
How do other state laws deal with involuntary admission?
It depends. It runs the gamut. So some have a very high threshold for inpatient commitment, and they require people to be clearly and presently dangerous before they can get an inpatient hospitalization. And Florida is along those lines. So, you know, on the spectrum, on this continuum of inpatient criteria, what it takes to get an involuntary inpatient treatment, that mm-hmm. is a higher threshold in Florida, and that falls along that side of the spectrum. Now, you have other states where it's a need for treatment standard. Does this person, based on their history, based on the trajectory of their illness, based on the institutional knowledge of this individual, can we see the trajectory they're going on, that they will decompensate to the point where they will become that someone who needs treatment for being dangerous to themselves or others?
Mm-hmm.
And so you can intervene and get them into inpatient care at a slightly easier pace, quicker mm-hmm. pace.
Frankie, this is Catherine. Do you see a state that is doing it right? Is there a gold standard out there?
Honestly, not yet. And it's because when we changed the laws and we deinstitutionalized in the 60s, as Robert pointed to, we didn't fulfill the promise of putting those community facilities in where we needed to. And so we've seen from the 60s until now this trans-institutionalism of all these people into the jails. And you've seen it in the news, the fact that we're talking about it on in this forum right now. States are trying to take this more seriously because we've reached a critical mass. We don't have any psychiatric beds available for people. We don't have the community resources. Mental health budgets have been obliterated across the country. And so people are trying to do it either because they realize the writing's on the wall and they need to make changes because this is an incredibly resource-taxing group of folks that need treatment and care and they keep getting sicker, but we don't have a space to put them and we don't have protocols in place to treat them. Or you have people in states that are doing this under duress because we've seen a bunch of lawsuits around from the criminal justice side, competency evaluations taking way too long. People are waiting for months or years even in jail awaiting competency restoration because there aren't psychiatric beds. Or you have it from the mental health side where people are being boarded in emergency rooms, which is a completely inappropriate place for someone with a psychiatric illness to be for a long period of time. And so you see those constraints on the system and people having to legislate themselves out of this difficult problem that we started to cause in the 60s, and we've been seeing the effects ever since.
Where does Florida rank? If you were to rank the states, how well does Florida do as far as helping residents struggling with these mental health issues?
It's really difficult. When you're talking from a civil commitment standard, again, the Baker Act is a really useful tool. So where some states would allow people to get much sicker before you could intervene and get a 72-hour hold and see what the problem is and what the best course of treatment and action is for an individual. You don't have that barrier in Florida. But then you come up against this giant wall of no resources, no availability of psychiatric beds. And so, and a criteria for inpatient commitment that's quite high. And so you need that middle ground in Florida so that somebody who meets criteria can get treatment in the community if that's a safe place for them. This individual that you all were talking about, Mr. Dunn, it sounds like he would have been a possible candidate for assisted outpatient treatment, which is involuntary treatment, but it's in the community. So if he was safe enough, you know, if he was in control of his actions enough where a judge would believe that they could live in the community and receive treatment in the community, and that was a less restrictive alternative for him, he would still have the community behavioral health system committed to him as well and make sure that someone was responsible for him taking his medication or responsible for him meeting with certain psychiatrists or treatment clinicians. And so without that sort of touch point and just letting people be under a 72-hour hold and then released to the community with no supports is a really difficult space that Florida finds itself in right now.
And Matt, actually, in that 2014 on those battery charges, so looking through all the documents with that case, there were some emails going back and forth. They were trying to get him into treatment, and he, you know, like probably many, many others, had to wait, I can't say how long, maybe it was a couple weeks to a month before he could get into treatment as well. But once he did, and he sort of did everything on his checklist that he had to do, he actually had his probation ended early.
Well, let me come back to you for a moment, Frankie Berger. You know, how common are waiting lists a barrier to treatment, not just in Orlando, Florida, but across the entire country?
Oh, they're horrible. I mean, it's atrocious. That is a national tragedy that's happening right now. It's a public health crisis. The waiting lists are terrible. And they're terrible on the civil side, so somebody who has no criminal charges against them, and it's terrible once that individual is in a space where they're facing criminal charges and need to be restored to competency. It's like we have one pie of available inpatient beds that has been shrinking and shrinking and shrinking since the 60s, and we're trying to divide that up in a really haphazard way. So some of these states, under duress from settlement agreements, are having to legislate that all of their beds are used strictly for forensic cases, so strictly for folks that are involved in the criminal justice system. Mm-hmm. And then what do you do with your civil patients, people who are not involved in the criminal justice system but need that level of treatment and care? Mm-hmm. So, yes, it is a national crisis.
Robert Wesley, I want to ask you about the advantage of ending parole early for someone with mental illness. What is that advantage for that person?
Well, if they've been med compliant and have shown good behavior and made positive strides, we would reward them to try and encourage that behavior. I think that makes sense. And if the family unit is close, if they're under control, that looks like a good option. I always revert to the schizophrenia because schizophrenia seems to just be so crushing that it divides families and that the child is usually out and doesn't have that sort of support system. And let me please address also how big the problem is so that we don't just think that it's one or two people in the criminal justice system. Florida Trend Magazine says the number one cause of hospitalization in Florida is giving birth. The number two cause of hospitalization in this third largest state is psychosis.
Mm-hmm. So, the difference there is between something that's planned and expected and something that may not be.
Well, and also that you're sitting there with your daughter in the emergency room with 105-degree temperature and waiting while a resident who had a two-week program in mental health is talking to a psychotic person trying to decide what course of action to take in that setting. And so that's why in our central receiving facility, some philanthropic efforts by local hospitals, which were actually good business, was to support the central receiving facility to clear their emergency departments and send those people directly to a mental health provider that had the expertise to handle them. So that creates the backlog as well, but solves another part of the health system.
I mean, it sounds like there are so many issues here we're talking about too. And Catherine, it sounds like there's more to explore as far as what to do from the mental health point of view as well.
Absolutely. You know, this was just sort of focused on the somebody should do something. And mm-hmm. so the residents on this app, the somebody seemed to be police. But there's the police part. There's the courts part. But then also there's state law. There's state funding. And everybody I talked to in reporting this piece, I asked, so who is that somebody and what is that something? And mm-hmm. unanimously, the answer is that somebody is all of us as a culture, as a community, as a state. You know, if we decide this is a problem and it's a priority that needs funding, then you lobby your lawmakers that it's sort of a legislative issue and that there needs to be funding behind that, which is kind of what I'm hearing from both of our guests here.
Robert Wesley, I mean, if you were to address that question, that the question that Catherine found on that Nextdoor app, someone should do something, who do you think that someone is and what should they do?
I mean, don't we always hear it after it's too late to intervene that you say, I knew there were problems. I knew there was something wrong with them. And if the neighbors had been the petitioners on the Baker Act rather than pushing that to the police officer to do, if the neighbors had gone to the clerk's office and two neighbors had signed and said, these are the dangers that are presenting and that we've seen him hit people with sticks, drive his car towards people, then they would have been, that would have had much more credibility in the court proceeding and in the determination of harm. The police officer wasn't there except for one incident. The police officer couldn't really report on how frequently it happens and what the behavior is. And it just, people need to stand up and help to address that.
Catherine, what about that?
Yeah, do people know that that's what they need to do? I mean, I found people said, well, I called 911. I filed a report. I guess maybe they haven't watched enough Law and Order marathons to make themselves dangerous here. Like, do people have that information to know they have that power?
I see you shrugging your shoulders there.
I can't solve that problem.
Well, let me put that question to you, Frankie Berger. Someone should do something. Who do you think that someone is and what should they do?
It's really difficult. I mean, folks need to be educated as to the fact that that is an avenue they can pursue, but then people in positions of authority, like when you call 911, they should be educated and be able to say, okay, well, this is the type of instance where a petition could happen. And, you know, can somebody do something? Yes. We're a legislation and policy shop, so I always go back to, what are the barriers that are existing in the law right now that could be changed that could help facilitate some of these issues not happening again? And I think, you know, some things definitely need to be done through the legislature, and that's going to be tough in Florida. But with expanding Medicaid, even if that's not something that's universal for the state, Terry McAuliffe in Virginia came up with a workaround. They also didn't expand Medicaid, but came up with a workaround for a pot of Medicaid funding that was strictly used for people with schizophrenia, bipolar disorder with psychotic features, these serious mental illnesses that have no cure, but they can all be treated. And so it's a Medicaid expansion for a targeted population, and I think that that could go pretty far to bolster some of the services available to this group of folks and make that easier. So that has to be done through the legislature.
There was a story in today's paper that the Medicaid exception is that Florida's going to exercise it and dedicate the funds to mental health and substance abuse. So I think we're right on the edge of some promise with that. There's another ray of hope, and that is every single law enforcement agency in our community participates in a program called Crisis Intervention Training, which is a way to try and treat a police officer how to assess the situation and look for mental or physical problems that the person may be having that explains the behavior. And the first people who volunteered to do it, obviously, are people who've been touched by mental illness or neighbors, friends, families, coworkers. And so with that understanding, rather than coming in with guns drawn to take the person down and use only the crime mentality, but then try and say, what's going on? What's happening with you? And listen and then make that determination can be extraordinarily helpful to avoid harm to everybody involved and also to provide for some outlet for treatment.
Well, Robert Wesley is the public defender with the 9th Judicial Circuit. Robert Wesley, thank you so much for joining us.
Appreciate your time.
We're also joined by Frankie Berger, Director of Advocacy at the Treatment Advocacy Center. Frankie Berger, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Catherine Welch, News Director with 90.7 WMFE. Catherine, thank you as well.
My pleasure.
Still to come, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar was the leading point scorer for the NBA when he retired from basketball in 1989. Since then, he's been a writer and advocate for social justice issues. Jabbar sees parallels between the student activists of today and the generation he grew up with. We're back with that conversation in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar played 20 seasons for the NBA with the Milwaukee Bucks and the LA Lakers. He's a six-time NBA champion and six-time MVP, and he's still the NBA's leading point scorer. He was appointed to President Obama's Council on Sports and Fitness, and in 2016 he was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Abdul-Jabbar's written a dozen books, including Coach, Wooden and Me, and Writings on the Wall, Searching for a New Equality Beyond Black and White. And he chairs the Skyhook Foundation, which aims to bring STEM education opportunities to underserved children. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, thank you so much for joining me.
Glad to talk to you.
We are going to talk basketball. It's March after all. But first, I want to talk to you about gun violence, because you have a second chapter after your basketball career doing advocacy work. And I wanted to ask you about the debate over gun control right now. You know, back in 2015, you wrote in a piece in Time magazine, quote, "I am as much a part of the American gun culture as many other Americans, but even I know that something's got to change when it comes to guns in America, because what we're doing right now, which is a whole lot of nothing, isn't working," end quote. So I'm wondering what you make of the student-led protests that we're seeing in the wake of the school shooting in Parkland.
Well, I think it's the very obvious... Transformation of another generation of young Americans who have seen too much violence, and I think it's a direct result of that, and I'm glad to see that their reaction has been what it is. We can't tolerate this situation perpetuating itself forever.
Do you see some parallels with the generation you grew up in as far as activism goes?
Yes, I do. You know, the whole thing, I think, has to do with motivation. The things that have happened to them that motivate them really have created a whole new consciousness. You know, the young people in our country really see that nothing has been done for decades, and we need to address this issue.
So those student activists, you know, they're getting a lot of attention right now, but what's your advice to them moving forward and as the months move on and the shooting recedes into the background?
Well, I think they have to, you know, understand that it has to be a long-term plan, because there's a lot of intransigence and indifference that they're trying to overcome. That's the worst. You know, people who aren't involved, or people who don't care. So, I think they have definitely taken on a big issue, and it's going to be a big problem, but they seem to be up for it.
An article in the New York Times focused on students at the march in Washington, D.C. last weekend and interviewed some students who were there to draw attention to a different kind of gun violence than the mass shooting which sparked that protest. And the newspaper quoted a student at the Friends School of Baltimore saying, quote, "It shouldn't take a mass shooting in a predominantly white area like Parkland to start caring about gun violence." Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, do you think that's the reason that there's more attention now being focused on this issue?
Well, I think what's happening is people are starting to see it as all part of the same issue. You know, the issue for gun violence in the black communities in America is part of the overall issue of gun violence in our country. It's just another segment of it. But now people are starting to see it all as one whole, and we have to get a grasp on it. We have to understand how pervasive and extensive it is, and do something that can change what has been a very bad problem for a very long time.
Activism is one thing, but what do you think needs to happen legislatively to make a real difference on gun violence, you know, whether it's mass shootings or it's the kind of gun violence that you wrote about in your piece for Time magazine?
What you're talking about, the solutions, I think that it's going to take a whole lot of input from a whole array of segments of our society to get to the bottom of it. But having background checks that are effective will go a long way. Updating and modernizing the listings of people who should not get their hands on firearms, if that could be done in a way that can solve that issue, I think that's a primary one right there, you know, because, you know, there are people who are involved in violent incidents who have been identified, but that information does not get around, and we have a tragic outcome just because of the people who fall through the cracks.
Well, let me ask you then about the shooting of an unarmed black man, Stephon Clark, in his grandmother's backyard in Sacramento. There's been big protests over that, including a blockade of the Golden One Center during a Sacramento Kings game. And since then, we've also seen Kings team members wearing his name on their shirts during warm-up, and also team owner Vivek Ranadive expressing support for the protesters. I'm wondering, how unusual is it to see the owner of a major professional sporting team like this speaking out on this issue?
Geez, I don't know. I've seen a couple of the NFL owners got behind Colin Kaepernick's protests. You'll find some variation in ownership ranks. And, you know, the NFL owners are a pretty conservative bunch. But, you know, the NBA, I would imagine that the NBA would be a little bit different because the NBA has a different fan base. So, you know, you'll see some variation there. But this issue goes through a lot of different segments of our society. And a lot of different people have a very strong opinion one way and the other.
Let me ask you then about Laura Ingraham on her Fox News show last year. She told LeBron James, quote, keep the political commentary to yourself, or as someone once said, shut up and dribble. I mean, what do you say to people who think politics has no place in sports?
Well, you know, the fact that I have a job as a professional athlete does not mean that I'm not supposed to be affected by some of the things that disturb me in American society. You know, LeBron James has every right to speak out on issues that happen in his community. I think he does a very noble and necessary job of motivating people to comment and or demonstrate when they feel that that is appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, my hat's off to him.
And I guess, you know, the NBA, the players, the owners, they have a platform, they can reach a lot of people. How much of an impact do you think they have on policy, on the kind of issues that they might be speaking out on?
Who knows, you know, how much. I think a lot of that has happened in places where, you know, I don't have access. But I think that the NBA has done a good job of representing the will of the players. That has been one of the strengths of the NBA.
Well, let me ask then about the NCAA. All eyes are on those basketballers now, with, of course, March Madness, which wraps up next week. College sports are worth billions of dollars, but the student-athletes are amateurs. They can't make money. Now, you wrote in an article for Jacobin magazine back in 2014 about the need to pay college athletes, and you talked about your own struggles to pay the bills when you played for UCLA. How likely do you think it is that the NCAA will change those rules and allow athletes to get paid, or at least change some of the rules around the way scholarships are administered?
I don't have much access to know what's going on right now, but it doesn't seem like there's been any real substantive movement toward change. So, you know, I don't think that the idea of paying the athletes has caught on in a way that would, you know, kindle a movement. Not yet, anyway.
Well, let me ask finally then about your Skyhook Foundation. It strives to bring STEM education opportunities to kids in underserved communities. NPR reported that there's a 5-year waiting list for the week-long STEM camps that the foundation runs, Camp Skyhook in the Los Angeles Unified School District. What does that tell you about the appetite for science and STEM education in those communities and the need for it?
Well, you know, I'm really encouraged that we have such a long waiting list. It shows that there's a thirst for these types of programs. I hope that we can get more funding so that we can make it more accessible to more kids in the LA Unified School District, because turning kids on to the various possibilities in their future really emboldens them and gives them a better idea of what they can do, you know, with their lives. So, you know, we hope that we continue to get the support of the various people who are kind enough to donate.
Well, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar will be speaking at Rollins College on Wednesday evening. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, you're welcome. It's nice talking to you.
Still to come, Nicholas Roberts on how MTV helped sharpen his songwriting skills. Intersection's back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Well, Nicholas Roberts is a singer-songwriter from Orlando. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So tell us a little bit about the first song you're going to play.
This first song is called River to a Flood. I wrote it when I was living up in Nashville. It was probably about 2 years, 3 years ago now. And I was in a basement apartment that I was renting off of Craigslist, and it was super cold, and it was kind of one of those self-reflection periods where you go, kind of, what am I doing, and where am I trying to make things go? So this is a song about that, about growing up and facing that.
All right, take it away.
Waking up and feeling old on your birthday. It wasn't meant to be this way. What would all your best friends say if they could see you now? And finding out the world don't work like you thought it would when you were still 18, but going on 23. Oh my God. And the beauty of it all, that I'll one day fall back into the earth where we came from. We'll lose all of our blood like a river to a flood. We'll lose all of this blood like a river. And the beauty of it all is that I'll one day fall back into the earth where we came from. We'll lose all of our blood like a river to a flood. We'll lose all of this blood like a river to a flood.
Nicholas Roberts with a song called River to a Flood. So, you grew up in Florida. Did your music change at all, that experience in Nashville? Did you absorb some of the culture, and did that sort of come through in the sounds you're making by the end of your time there?
For sure. I think definitely a lot of lessons on the craft of songwriting living up there. I think when you're just getting started or figuring stuff out, you just kind of write songs how you think songs are written, but going up there and seeing there's a whole craft and people have been studying this for a long time, just it definitely influenced the way that I think about songwriting and structure and just pacing and getting the listener involved and all that sort of stuff that goes on behind the curtain.
So the next song you're going to play is called The Rest of Our Lives. Tell me a little bit about this one.
Yeah, this is this song is the title off of a record that I put out last year by the same name. And I wrote this song kind of in between where I was living in Nashville towards the end, right before I moved home. I had started this song and I was working as a substitute teacher full time to kind of pay bills and stuff. And this song tried to capture again some of that kind of youthful, just trying to figure stuff out, trying to piece a relationship that I had here and still have, piece that together with, you know, pursuing your dreams.
Were you a music teacher?
Some days I was. Some days I was fortunate enough. Up there, a lot of the big music companies sponsor local music programs. And so you'll walk into a middle school classroom and there's $80,000 of guitars and amps and just crazy stuff up there that that I don't ever remember seeing here in mm-hmm. middle school. So yeah, it was a lot of fun being able to do music days, but it was a lot of PE, a lot of middle school math, stuff like that.
Okay, well, the rest of our lives, take it away.
All right. I'm in no hurry to write this story. I just wish you would grab a pen. This won't be graded.
Nicholas Roberts with a song called The Rest of Our Lives. Now, you've got some songs that have gotten airplay on television as well. Mm. Tell me about those.
Yeah, a lot of them are a little bit older, but about a year ago or a year and a half ago, after my record came out, I signed with a licensing company out of Los Angeles that helps me pitch to TV and film. And even before that, when I was living in Nashville, I'm just fortunate enough to meet the right people that kind of help place stuff. A music blog a number of years ago covered a record that I put out, and the blogger ended up working at MTV and kind of got my foot in the door putting some songs on TV shows a number of years ago, and that kind of got the ball rolling for me to be able to keep doing that, and it's great.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the shows people might have heard your music on?
Ooh, get a lot of stuff on MTV, Catfish, Teen Mom, Jersey Shore, when that was back on air. And I think, I'm trying to think, there was a couple CNN documentary series, Bill Wire, mm-hmm. that had a show. Yeah, just bits and pieces here and there. It's always really cool when you turn the TV on and hear it playing back. Oh, wow. That's, mm-hmm. that's cool.
So one more song.
Mm.
Dance With Me?
Yeah. This is one of those newer songs that I haven't put out yet, but kind of came from a bout of just trying to write. Yeah, this is one of those songs. I won't say too much about what it's about, but I had a lot of fun writing it. So. I would run away with you to somewhere with an ocean view. And even if we never arrive, these are the best days of our life. Dance with me, dance while we're young. 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 Dance with me, dance while we're young.
Nicholas Roberts, thank you so much for coming and performing for us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. Big fan of the show.
And we interviewed Nicholas Roberts in November last year. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. The show's producer is Brendan Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. You can download the podcast from iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. We're on the NPR One app and online at wmfe.org/intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Follow me on Twitter at Matthew_Petty. And thanks for listening.